Coming up on This Week in Google, I'm filling in for Leo Laporte while he's still out. I'll be back next week. Don't worry. I've got Aaron Newcomb, Gina Trapani, and of course, Jeff Jarvis here. We're going to talk all about the results of the Right to be Forgotten in only 3 months' time, Google's new Beacon platform, phone and technology intrusion, there's the Asus Chromebook Flip, and so much more. Stay tuned. This Week in Google is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is TWiG. This Week in Google, episode 309, recorded on Wednesday, July 15th, 2015. Fetish Fodder. This Week in Google is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution designed to help small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twig. And by LegalZoom. If you're looking to incorporate, form an LLC, get a trademark, and more, LegalZoom can help you get started the right way. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but can connect you with an independent attorney. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TWIG in the referral box at checkout for your special discount. Hello, everyone, and welcome to TWIG This Week in Google. Leo is still out, although he's actually in the area. They returned home. Leo and Lisa returned home yesterday, so I have a feeling they're kind of battling jet lag at the moment, but I'm pretty certain that Leo is going to be in starting this weekend, so you are going to be Leo-less for not much longer. In his place, I'm sitting here, obviously, not switching the show today. Jason Howell, I'm hosting, and I love it. Last time I got to host, it was just a lot of fun, so I'm happy to be in this seat again. And I've got an awesome panel, of course, returning the show as always. Jeff Jarvis to my right. How are you doing today, Jeff?
Hey.
Buzzmachine.com. And, well, let's just say there's some really good Jeff fodder in today's rundown. So I have a feeling there might be a little discussion on Right to be Forgotten. What is fodder? That's a really good question. It's a word that I use, but I've never actually analyzed it. Google? What do you think fodder is?
What is fodder? It is food, especially dried hay or feed for cattle or other livestock.
I'm sorry that I presented
there's a lot of there's a lot of my cud in the show today.
Oh, Jeff, thank you for starting things off so strong. I really appreciate it. Is my face getting red? It probably should be.
No, mine is. Mine is always red.
Oh, that's true.
The problem.
That's true. Well, don't worry about it. The window in front of you is still keeping you a nice hue of blue, so it's all good. Also joining me today, Gina Trapani is back a mere 2 weeks after her last appearance.
Hi.
How's it going,
Gina? So good to be here. Great. It's going great. I was thinking maybe like not catnip, but like Jeff Nip. We can think of it that way.
Now I'm analyzing like my own internal dictionary and realizing maybe I need to strike fodder from the list.
No, fodder's okay. Fodder's all
is
right.
Is it? Is it all right?
You just turned me into a cow, but it's okay.
Okay. That was not my intention. Oh, boy. So stoked to have you guys. Also, Aaron Newcomb, sitting here in studio in the flesh right next to me. How you doing,
sir? Right. Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
You know, I realize when I'm sitting down for a show of the caliber of TWiG, what my best strategy is to surround me with insanely smart individuals and let them do the talking. So that's why we're here. So hopefully that strategy works this time around. I know it will because these guys are all awesome. So what should we talk about first here? We've got a lot of stories in today's rundown. Let's do you want to start with revenue because it's at the top? Is that an exciting kicker? Google's revenue growth apparently is slowing down. Obviously, things are kind of slowing down at Google. They're also hiring less workers. In the first quarter of 2015, Google only added 1,819 employees. That's the smallest bump since the fourth quarter of 2013. So they're kind of slowing things down. You know, the groups aren't hiring as much. Actually, Google, I guess, is being selective as far as which groups can hire, whereas I think in the past it was kind of like a freewheeling, like, yeah, sure, you, whatever, hire all you want. For instance, last year, Google Plus saw a hiring cap while Nest was given the room to grow. So, and I think we've all kind of seen Google de-emphasize Google Plus, so that kind of makes sense. I don't know. What do you guys think? Is there anything to worry about? Is there any story here? Is this just how business works?
Yeah.
What do you think, Jeff?
So I put something on the rundown where Business Insider said the reason they're worried about Google is... Now, where'd that go? Where'd that go? It's on here somewhere. Oh, hell. Oh, hell. I can't find it now, but basically the growth rate is slowing down. Well, mm-hmm. when you're that gigantic, I mean, Google's long said that when you become size becomes your own enemy, and that's the issue.
At some
and
point,
and that's something yeah. we've heard from from one of the founders. I think it was. I'm not sure if it was Larry. I think it was probably Larry, right? Saying that like Google's biggest challenge is itself, and figuring out how to best use its resources. I mean, I don't think it's a big deal. Only hiring 1,800 new employees. That's you're in good shape.
1,800 employees.
And though I imagine from the inside, as a Googler, being in a group that doesn't have the green light to hire would be a little demoralizing, mm-hmm. right? Especially since you know Google hires people who are super passionate and ambitious and wanna and go to a company like Google because they want to build things at tremendous scale. So I think if there's any kind of signal from the top that the thing that they're working on, whether it's Google Plus or whatever, doesn't have the attention of the higher ups or like isn't in a growth phase, that could be a little that might put me off. But overall, I don't think it's that big a deal. I mean, I'd love to know which groups hired and which groups didn't, like which ones had the cap. Google Plus, it was kind of clear, right, that was happening. But, you know, where else? And there's no way to tell that, right? Because so many groups are not public or people just don't know what groups there are. Mm-hmm.
I guess I shouldn't be waiting for the phone to ring with a job offer. It's...
Well, not if what you're trying to do is work in the Google Plus division.
No.
Right.
But Nest, maybe so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. All right. So maybe that wasn't the best.
We'll see. We'll also see. I think probably while we're on the air.
Yeah.
Google's numbers will be coming out. I think today is.
Oh, is it today or tomorrow? I know. Yeah, it's definitely
results day.
Okay, definitely soon. Maybe hopefully that'll be breaking news that we can slam into today's episode to kind of see how that compares.
Chat room, keep an eye on that, will you?
Yeah, yeah. Work for us. Hey, let's talk about something that I know will get everybody kind of a little amplified here. Sundar Pichai spoke with Connor Doherty of the New York Times about intrusive technology and how it impacts our lives. I thought it was an interesting conversation. The interview itself is one thing, and Jeff, we'll talk about that here in a second. The point that Pichai was kind of making repeatedly through the interview, I thought were some interesting points. He's basically talking about how Google's aim with their products is to be user-centric, to make users happier, more productive people, not to get in the way and deteriorate the quality of life. Basically, that the burden is on the user right now. And Sundar believes that, you know, that's not the way it should be. The burden should actually be on Google to create an experience, and developers to create apps that relieve the burden of the user and actually place the information in a user's hands without the user having to kind of seek it out. So I thought it was kind of an interesting talk. Did you get a chance to take a look at that, Aaron?
No, I was just looking at it. I'm just trying to figure out. I mean, what do you guys think? I think it should be in the hands of the user. I mean, I guess so, but I mean, it seems like Google's in a pretty good position to do that, though, right?
Excuse me while I kill an ant. I'll be right back.
Oh, no.
You know, I think Pichai really kind of touched on what I think is probably one of the biggest challenges for Google in product design, which is like Google wants to create products that anticipate your needs maybe before you even know that you need them, right? To give you the answer before you ask. But they want to do that without being prescriptive. Right. So this interviewer, which Jeff will speak to in a minute, you know, said, you know, are we all on our phones during dinner? Like, is this during dinner time with our family? Is this a good thing? And Pichai was like, that's not a technology decision. Right. Like that's a human decision. That's a parent's decision when kids are involved, you know, but how do you, you know, we all know sort of the power of defaults and the power of the way like a great app works can really affect your behavior. So it was interesting to hear him talk about being user-centric. And then this interview was just really, really pushing him in this direction of, but is this really making our lives better? I think it's clear to particularly viewers of this show that it's a net positive. I'm pretty optimistic about technology, and I think probably most people in our audience are. Maybe that's up for debate. That's not up for debate for me. But it did feel like this interviewer was just digging for, you know, how we're all buried in our screens and not connecting, you know, with each other and not present anymore.
Yeah, he was writing another story that appeared as a commentary in Sunday Review in the Times about applications and hardware that try to wean you off your phone dependency. So he was looking for a quote from Sundar. I've been a reporter. I teach it. I get what's going on here. It's the journalistic disease of saying, I wrote the whole story. Now there's this little empty spot there, just perfect for a Sundar Pichai quote. And I'm going to go and get that quote. And so then you ask Sundar the question, basically, aren't phones kind of ruining our lives and our dinner? And Sundar doesn't cooperate with him and says, well, no, I don't think so. I think that we're trying to give people what they want. So what do you do as a reporter? You ask the question again and again and again. Yeah. I count basically six times you essentially ask the same question. And Sundar is of a rank he can't say, you know, kid, F you. I'm not going to answer because what I do at some point when this happens to me and I go get interviewed often when it happens and I see it happening, I say, listen, you can ask the question as often as you like. I'm not going to give you the answer you want, so stop. Mm. But Sundar can't say that because otherwise he's going to sound like he's being pissy. So the poor guy has to sit there and just wait and wait through it again and then find another way to say, no, I don't agree with you, without saying, no, I don't agree with you. And so he said, as Gina pointed out, he said, listen, is it the phone's decision? Is it Google's decision what kids or parents should do during dinner? That's for families to do. Who wants Google in the middle of that? No. And he says, you're not asking a technology question. We're here to tech technology. The other problem I have is, and I know he's on the beat, but you have the chance to sit down with the second most powerful man at the most powerful company on earth. And this is all you do? Is to say, aren't the things you're making really causing life to be awful? Ugh. That's what drives me nuts. It's more of the techno panic is the beat. And I just see more and more and more of this going on these days where publications that I respect are just buying right in to the contrarian view of technology that, well, wait a second, though. Isn't this bad? Isn't this bad? And, okay, I get the point. And maybe a discussion would be fine, but jeez.
I really liked how he kind of used himself as an example. You know, it was the reporter was asking, like, do you find in meetings that people are on their laptops or on their phones? And he said, well, one thing that I've learned about myself is that I don't multitask well. Some people do, but I don't. So I don't check email all day long. I do email, you know, separately and distinct from the rest of my work. And that's how I work. Right. And I felt like, you know, if he was being pissy, as you said, Jeff, he would have been like, this is a matter of self-awareness, of figuring out who you are and what your priorities are. And you check your email, you look at your phone, not as an impulse, but, you know, as a mindful decision, because it's the right thing to do at the moment. Right. You know, right. if your sister's kid's about to get born, you check your phone. If not, then you don't.
A couple of great moments where Sundar said, well, you know what? We had a dinner before I.O. and we usually try to put the phones in the basket. But the one group that can't give up their phones is the PR people because you damn reporters keep calling them. Right? He said it nicer than that, but that was what it was. My other favorite moment was the reporter says, and I found this just absurd. Well, one way that I try to, you know, tame my own evil instincts with phones is I allow it to be in only one room in the house. You know, I imagine that he got grandma's telephone. Remember the old telephone table that sat in grandma's front room?
Yep. Yeah.
And and that's where the phone was. You had the little chair next to the phone and the wire into the wall next to the phone. Hey, we invented new technology that lets you carry it anywhere. Wow. I'm going to put it back in one room with a string tied there.
Ah. You know, but having said that, I suppose
it still falls on the user in that case, right? If that works for you to curb your usage patterns, then I guess more power to you. And what Sundar is definitely saying here is it's not really up to Google to make those decisions. And it seemed, right, exactly. It seemed like the interviewer was trying to get that, was trying to get the, like, Google has a master plan for how you should use your device. And right. And what Sundar repeatedly said, as you were saying, is that that doesn't lie in Google's responsibility. That's up to an individual to make that type of decision.
You know, it's a moment when I actually fear for, I feel for the PR people, because you know they're sitting there saying, oh, God, all right, he's just going to get his ass. Please, Sundar, please don't yell at him, please. Thank you, Sundar. I got to work with this guy. Thank you.
You know, I completely agree that it's not Google's responsibility, and I'm really glad to hear Pichai say that. But, you know, the reality is, like, as an app maker, particularly an app with notifications, which is every app now, like, there are times, and Google has to make this decision all the time with their product design, when they're like, is this piece of information worth the user's attention, and should it be a push notification right now that's potentially going to make that user's phone ding, right? Like, am I justified making this person's phone ding? They have to answer that question constantly. Or, you know, is this information worthwhile putting it in a Google Now card? You know, and making somebody look at it and parse it, right? And, like, this is, you know, if you think about all the users and all the time they spend looking at these things, it's, you know, millions and millions and millions of human hours. So, I mean, Google does have to make those decisions, you know, on some level, certainly on the app level. I mean, any app, even if you make an app that does email notifications, any app that takes your attention, which is every app, like, the designer has to make those decisions. And I think that's what he means by user-centric, right? Like, putting the human who is using this app at the forefront versus putting the interests of the company who's making the app or the app itself at the
forefront. You're really right, Gina. As always, you're really right. And it's not just the app maker. It's also in my business. Now news has the way to send an alert to make your wrist or your pocket buzz. Mm-hmm. We in news are doing a terrible job at alerts. We're awful at it because it's still one size fits all. So I, you know, the Guardian and the New York Times and everybody tells me Pluto pictures.
Right.
Yeah, I got them. Got Pluto pictures. You know, and one of them I appreciate. So what does that require? It requires knowledge about me and data points about me to give me relevance. Well, that requires what Circa would have allowed, which is me to follow stories. It requires other data points that will then require a fight in Germany about how they're alerting us because they're violating our privacy. And but those who fill the apps, those who talk through those apps, are also going to have to make the same decisions. My friend Jim Brady, formerly of the Washington Post and other places, now has a thing called Billy Penn in Philadelphia. He says that an alert should be worth interrupting a meeting for.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
Uh-huh. It really is. Like, oh, sorry.
That's okay. I'll put it down. I got the note going in right now, Jeff. It's okay.
All right. Hold on. Here's a dollar going in the jar. Sorry. My dirty word jar. Twit. Anyway. So Sundar, I think, did very well. There was still interesting stuff there, but I felt for him. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, and one thing, now that I'm not multitasking anymore and I can respond to the question. Is that relevant? A little bit. One thing that I've noticed is that you both kind of alluded to this. I mean, not that it's necessarily Google's responsibility, but what I'm glad to see them doing anyway and taking a lead on some of this thing is putting in the option. So you both mentioned a couple apps that have the option now. Are you interested in this? Because it eventually, right. Inevitably, it is up to the user. So you mentioned the news and weather app, and you mentioned the cards, right? The Google Now cards, and both of those have the option to say, "Are you interested in this?" No, I'm not interested in this. I don't want to know about this. Maybe it's something my daughter was searching for on my account, and you know, I'm not interested in cupcakes, so I don't want to be notified about that. So I will give them kudos for actually beginning to put those controls in there, at least to prompt the user to make sure, let's verify whether this is important or not. And then the user's in control of more of what pops up and interrupts them in the middle of a meeting or in the middle of dinner.
And let me be clear, I do want to be interrupted by Pluto. I was watching NASA TV. I am absolutely mesmerized by Pluto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that makes me.
I tweeted the other day that it's one of those moments in life when I really regret not having studied science well enough and become a scientist. You know, how great to be involved in that reality. How great to see a standing ovation for data. Yeah, interrupt me for that, please.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. If I may, because I am surrounded by very smart, intelligent folks. And by the way, so what do we have down there? Oh, so this is like so this is the
mountains
image.
Of ice.
By the way, before I get into that thought, this is the kind of close-up of Pluto's surface that was released just, I think, a couple of hours ago. Yeah, minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I know. It's awesome seeing this.
11,000 feet high mountains of ice.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
That's crazy stuff. And the fact that they're able to do what they did.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Get that back so quickly.
And isn't it true that the whole surface of Pluto is about the size of Russia? Like if you take Russia and wrap it up into a ball, that's about the size. Like when you see the images, you think, oh yeah, like this is probably about the same size as Earth or something, but it's actually quite a small sphere.
My two favorite things. Number one is I can't wait to refer to a steely corporate executive as having a heart as cold as Pluto's. I just can't wait to do that. There'll be a moment when I can.
Nerdy burn.
It's in the bag.
Nerdy burn.
It's in there. The other is that in the press conference, I guess yesterday or day before yesterday, I guess it was, somebody asked, does it snow on Pluto? And the answer was yes. I just love that idea. It snows on Pluto.
Yeah. Wow.
Snows nitrogen and methane and God knows what, but it snows.
Yep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to drag us.
No. Don't get me wrong. I love Pluto, and I'm also still kind of amazed that an image of Disney Pluto actually fits on Pluto, the planet, pretty snugly, I might add. So there's something going on there that Disney folks aren't telling us about. Anyways, one question I have related to phone intrusion, and this was just something that I kind of thought about after reading the interview yesterday and then kind of thinking about it this morning and everything. Total selfish question. I'm merely asking this because I'm surrounded by minds that I want to know where you guys fall on this. So when you're talking about phone intrusion, you're talking about kind of the pull that phones and, this kind of technology has in our lives now, even compared to what it was like 10, 15, 20 years ago. Like there's no doubt we're walking around with computers in our pockets and, you know, there's a whole host of things that, you know, things that pull us into that experience regularly as a result of just having that kind of power in our pockets. And so what I see, you know, primarily in our home is, you know, I have a 5-year-old daughter and I can kind of, I'm trying to measure my use of the phone around her because I want to set an example that I don't live my life inside of a screen. Even though my job and what we do in the technology world is, I mean, it's, we work in technology. So it's not crazy to think that that's not normal in some ways. But so I'm trying to kind of like convey that and not create bad lifelong habits. If there is such a thing, I find myself kind of conflicted, right? One hand, like I've lived a life of technology. I work in technology. I love technology. So I want to instill that. And I think that we have to, because this is kind of the future of the next generation is so intertwined in the world of technology. But then at the same time, there's another part of me that kind of fears this kind of addiction slash abuse slash overuse aspect of it. And I don't know how to
Jason,
balance that.
Here's what I think you do. I think you have trust and faith in first your child and second in yours and your wife's parenting. That, you know, there was a time, I'm going to go to a drinking game, guys, Gutenberg. There was a time after the Gutenberg press when people said, oh my God, books are going to ruin us. People are spending too much time reading books. Books are bad for you. Books are horrible. And now books are, you know, not reading books is a very bad thing. People are smart. People will figure it out. Your child will figure it out. Yeah, they'll go overboard. You know, I was raised watching TV, and that's why I'm so crazy. But I became a TV critic. It had its advantages.
Yeah.
You know, same with Howard Stern encouraged his kids to watch TV. He put TVs in their rooms because that's how he was raised. Yeah. It gave him a career. I think that we'll use these devices and things as we will, and if somebody overuses them, if they're just spending all their day on the computer, it's probably indicating something else happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Gina, how are you as a mom? How are you thinking about this?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of deep in this. I mean, I try to. I think the thing that I struggle with is that, you know, my co-parent and I are both often will pick up the phone and start doing something, and we could be doing hundreds of different things. There's so many possibilities, but it looks exactly the same, right? Mm-hmm. To my daughter, who said the first thing she says is, "What are you doing, Mama?" Like, she wants to know what we're doing on the phone. So I try to use voice search if I'm Googling something so that she knows what I'm doing. Or I try to say, like, I'm texting your aunt right now, or I'm looking up a YouTube video, or I'm looking at this recipe because Mama's cooking right now. So I try to, like, narrate to her so that she understands the range of things that are happening when I'm looking at the screen, and just she understands why I'm not looking at her. You know, I think it has a lot to do with the kid too. Like, my daughter's almost 3 and she's a little delayed developmentally, like her gross motor skills. So one of the things that her doctors and therapists have told us is that it's really important that she's as active as we can get her to be, right? And I know, like most people, myself included, if I'm in front of a screen, I just kind of go limp, right? Like, I'm not moving. I'm not climbing or running or walking, right? Unless I'm at my standing desk, right? It's just really easy to become super cerebral and not be active. So I try to limit her screen time so that just for that, because I'm just trying to get her to be more active because that's important for her developmentally right now. But she's going to grow out of that. She's going to catch up and she's going to be fine. And I think that this is going to be like a lifelong thing. I mean, I spent hours. I remember clear as day. I was 9 years old. We had our first computer, and I was sitting in the den using it in my house in the 1980s. And I heard my mom in the hallway telling my dad, you know, she really should go outside and make some friends. Right?
Same here.
I remember that clear as day, and I remember feeling like, oh, you know, like maybe I'm kind of a loser because I don't have friends, but I'd much rather be here writing this basic, right? Like, so, I'm going to support her interest, and if she wants to be on screen, like, great. My 10-year-old nephew. He was making these like YouTube videos of narrating himself playing Minecraft, and I think it's amazing. He's such a good speaker. He's totally into it, so I want to support his passion, and if that means being in front of a screen, that's fine. I spend most of my life in front of a screen.
No, I know. So, totally, you know. And that's part of why I feel so hypocritical thinking about these things, but I just find myself thinking about it a lot, and not just about my own kid, but just about, you know, society at large, realizing that technology is kind of the era that we are in. This is the era of technology, and it's just kind of, this is how we live our lives. It's our livelihood for a lot of us. But then at the same time, it goes counter to a lot of the things that, like, I heard when I was a kid. Not that my parents dissuaded me from being into things that were, you know, fell in the realm of technology, but, you know, that there is an unhealthy, you know, overuse of this kind of stuff, and you got to get out and be active and all that kind of stuff. Right. And, you know, it's a hard kind of line to walk and try and figure out for yourself. True.
And it gets worse when they become teenagers, because that's when you're really trying to instill some of those future good employee worker habits, right? Mm-hmm. And it gets difficult for me because I'm at home. I work from home most of the time, and I'll be in one of these huge meetings with like 30 people on the phone or something, and the kids will be home. It's summertime. They're out of school, and they'll come in the office where I work. And, I have my headphones on and stuff, and I'll say, shh, I'm in a meeting, you know, you got to go out. You know, and then they'll look at the computer screen and they'll say, Dad, no, you're not. You're playing Goat Simulator, you know, because I need a distraction sometimes. I'll admit, when I'm in one of these meetings, sometimes I need a distraction. So I'm listening, actively participating, but at the same time, I'm just, you know, doing something like doodling. But instead of doodling, it's playing Goat Simulator. And so that becomes a challenge then to instruct them. But it's both good and bad. I think, maybe I'm telling them the wrong thing. Maybe I'm, you know, giving them this habit where they're not going to take work seriously. And then I think, wait a second, maybe they shouldn't take work so seriously, actually. Like, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe they should learn to take breaks, have a good time when they can, still get their work done. Maybe I'm instilling something that will actually be beneficial in the end. I don't know.
And I mean, if what you're showing them is that they should play Goat Simulator, I think that's pretty noble. It's a great game.
I don't think I want to know what that is.
Goat Simulator.
Don't worry.
I think it reminds me of Gina will get this, of Anil's T-shirt. We will say no more.
I don't know what that is, but it really is exactly what it says. It really is. You are a goat.
It's a simulator.
You're walking the goat around. Headbutting things. It's
this is
ridiculous.
Much more
it's
innocuous.
Not even...
This is much less. Much more.
All right. Hey, let's, before we move on, let's take a break from Goat Simulator to sponsor read. This episode of This Week in Google is brought to you by FreshBooks. And it's kind of a question for, you know, all of the fearless entrepreneurs that are out there running a small business. If you started this minute, how much time is it going to take you to catch up on all of, you know, the other stuff like client invoices, organizing all of your receipts, figuring out which client owes you what and when? My wife owns a business, and I know she spends a lot of time with this kind of stuff. It can feel overwhelming, obviously. And, you know, one way to kind of tackle this is to give FreshBooks a try. Leo swears by FreshBooks. Anyone who watches This Week in Google knows that. He's a huge fan, has been using it for years. FreshBooks, it's super simple. It's a cloud accounting software. Over 5 million people are using it right now. And that's because it saves them time billing and you get paid faster. FreshBooks lets you create and send just really slick, personalized invoices. They look awesome. They look professional in under a minute. So it's super fast to do it as well. FreshBooks makes it easy to capture and manage your expenses. You can use actually the camera on your phone. You can take pictures and manage your receipts straight from there. The mobile app also lets you keep track of all of your billable hours while you're on the go. And if you need help, the FreshBooks support team, the rock stars actually, are famous for their knowledge, and a real person is there ready to help you out, ready to amaze you with their helpfulness. So you should check it out for yourself. Getting started, super simple. It's totally free for 30 days with no obligation to you. Go to freshbooks.com/twig. Don't forget to enter twig in the how did you hear about us section so that they know that you heard about it from This Week in Google. Start your 30-day free trial today. And we thank FreshBooks for supporting this episode of This Week in Google. All right. So let's see here. Why don't we talk a little bit about... Jeff, are you ready? Are you warmed up? I figured you needed a little warm-up to get to the right to be forgotten stuff. How are you feeling?
Leicester and Schutzrecht. I just want to warm up my brain. Leicester and Schutzrecht. Okay, I'm there. Yeah.
All right, so tell us what's going on here. We have a couple of stories in here. And
I'm not exactly sure how this happened. I don't know, Gina, whether you can describe it, but somehow Google left, the way The Guardian put it, is they left in their source code, I don't know what that exactly means in this context.
I couldn't figure that out either, by the way.
Yeah, the ability to find out what Google was trying to categorize the requests and the right to be forgotten. And they evidently left some data in that. The way I quote, "The Guardian has discovered new data hidden in source code on Google's own transparency report that indicates the scale and flavor of the types of requests being dealt with by Google." So I think it just means that it was kind of hidden within an app and they found it in the source. And then Google came back and said, yeah, we were trying to categorize these things, but we actually found the data wasn't very good, so we stopped doing it. And so now there's a whole story about this data that Google doesn't think is very good. But what we find out is that a large, at least with that categorization, 95% of the 220,000 requests made to Google were from plain folks trying to get rid of things about them. That is to say, not criminals, politicians, or high-profile public figures. Well, I guess 95% of the world is people who are not criminals, politicians, or high-profile public figures. So in some sense, that makes sense. Includes a woman whose name appeared in prominent news articles after her husband died, another seeking removal of her dress, an individual who contracted HIV a decade ago, and so on and so forth. And I can hear people say right off the bat, well, hey, Jarvis, you're against this right to be forgotten. What about these plain folks who just want to take stuff down? And I'm going to hold firm here and say a couple things. One is that it's ridiculous to force a company to take things down upon request. Google also gets crap again for being the court of this. Well, Google was put in that position. And my view on this is that if a court tells Google under a law of a nation, you must take something down, then fine. Google at this point, the more I think about it, the more I think Google was mistaken to agree even though it was the final court decision, they should have just done some civil disobedience of a sort and say, no, you don't want us judging this. If a court tells us to take it down, we'll take it down. But we're not going to be the judge of taking this down. Because this is the position Google's in now, where they're constantly going to be judged for their judgment on the requests that are made to them. So I think that's the story, unless anybody else has a different view of it.
Well, this has only taken place in the last couple of months, right? Like, this only started mid-April. And I think they're saying more than a million links have been requested to be taken down, 602,000 have been deleted as a result in just 2 months.
It also has rejection percentages based on various categories and countries.
Oh, yeah. So I'm looking at, I was determined to find out where this data was hidden. So if you go to archive.org's snapshot of this transparency report from, I think I went to the one in like March, and you view the source, there are huge blocks of JSON data that the JavaScript is using to render some of those pie charts. And it's been scrubbed out of the current live version, but if you look at the archive.org version, they definitely provided a bunch more numbers that are not represented in those charts. So,
you cracked the code, Gina.
Good job, Guardian. Wow. That's
you
crazy.
Hacker, you.
Oh, yeah, I know how to use view source, so, you know, who should hire me? That's some investigative reporting. That's interesting. I wonder if they got tipped off to that.
Yeah, no kidding. How do you just discover that? Like, just fall into that? Oh, I guess we'll just view the source and see if maybe they inadvertently, I don't know, left some data in there.
Yeah,
that you can't actually get access to.
So here's Google's statement.
Yeah,
we've always aimed to be transparent as possible about our right to be forgotten decisions. The data the Guardian found in our transparency report source code does, of course, come from Google, but it was part of a test to figure out how we could best categorize requests. We discontinued that test in March because the data was, or were, if you prefer, not reliable enough for publication. We are, however, currently working on ways to improve our transparency reporting. Right? So I think it's straightforward. But then they go to a Dutch researcher specializing in the liabilities of search engine providers. Jesus, is that that's a narrow specialty. Google is taking decisions that are publicly relevant. As such, it is becoming almost like a court or government, but without the fundamental checks on its power. Whoa, Nelly.
Yeah.
Google never wanted to do this. Google was forced to do this by a FACACTA court decision that forced them to be the decider. Yes, I agree. It's insane for Google to make these decisions. I think Google would readily agree with that. We have laws about content that exist. These go way past that. There are libel laws and defamation laws and other laws about things that can be taken down. This is not any of that. This just says, yeah, Google, I don't really like that haircut. I demand that you take down that picture of my hair. I was having a bad hair day, and nobody should see that hair. I'm doing my Leo imitation of somebody.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, thank you. Just imagine me in Lederhosen. It's absurd. And so now to attack Google because Google is forced to make decisions Google doesn't want to make, and then to go after them for the transparency they give and say they don't have enough transparency. Their heads must explode.
Yeah.
And I don't see, I mean, there's a lot of that. I mean, how do you tell that 95% or whatever? I mean, if it was just written in the code, I mean, there's so many variables that could go into that.
Amen.
How do you even know, like, oh, this person served in office once, or, you know, maybe he was the head of the PTA or something, like, and they said, oh, this is a famous person, so he falls into that 5% category. In any way, I think this just goes to prove that Google's doing their job. Right. Yes. I mean, they were doing what they were told to do. Like, to me, this seemed like a little bit of a non-story. It had a big headline, but I was like, OK, so Google's doing what they were told to do in a way that seems fair because the numbers represent what you would imagine they should be. Mm-hmm. To me, that was it. It was almost a non-story. Mm-hmm.
Take that, Jason.
Fine.
Sorry. Fine. But I'm glad you included it in the rundown. I'm glad we were able to talk about it, Jason.
Yes,
believe me, when I knew I was hosting, I put everything in the rundown, everything that I found that said Google in it. I suppose we could continue down the, and let me try this for myself, Leistungsschutzrecht. No.
Let's all have a lesson right now.
All right.
Leist, everybody. Leist.
Leist.
Ungs.
Uns.
Uns.
Schutz.
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 Recht.
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 Leist,
uns, Leist,
Schutz, Schutz,
Schutz,
Recht. Recht.
Man, that is not easy.
No, it's not.
That took me six years. Leist, uns, yeah. Schutz, Recht. Was that close?
That was very good. That was very good.
Not even going to try again because I'm pretty certain I'm not going to get it. So, Jeff, you also put in here the EU commissioner is
in charge of digital, who scares me every time he speaks. Günther Oettinger is now saying that he still has plans to enable an ancillary copyright law, which is English for Leistungsschutzrecht, for all press publishers across all of Europe by the end of 2016. Now, mind you, it's already led to the disaster of the Spain link tax and the killing of Google News there, and leading to publishers losing 10 to 15% of their traffic in an instant. And I saw a story the other day, I couldn't find it right before the show, it was in, I think, Der Spiegel, that said that authorities in Germany warned lawmakers that the law doesn't make any sense. And they still went ahead with it anyway. And I'm not going to bore everybody with the story again, but this, you're going to hear me saying this word again and again and again over the next 2 years. I just warn you, folks, start a drinking game now.
Okay. Well, I got nothing on that one.
Me neither.
Yeah. All right. Let's, unless you want to try and say Leistungsschutzrecht again, which I don't, because I obviously can't.
I can't do it.
You've been drinking on the show. Shame on you, gentlemen.
I wish.
Only Gina is sober here.
Hey, let's talk about maps a little bit. So, this is kind of cool. So last week we kind of got a little freaked out. Ain't gonna lie about Deep Dream and the fact that it can put dog faces in your spaghetti, among very other things, which, by the way, the more I look at those Deep Dream images, it really looks like all it does is place dogs everywhere.
Is
that true? Like, I feel like dogs appear in every image in some way, shape, or form. Like, it's very dog-focused. Mm-hmm. Don't know why. Don't understand why. But anyways, Google has something else that's kind of deep that they're working on. And I don't know if we're going to see this anytime soon in, like, a physical form that we can mess around with. But they did put up some examples.
They have some demos, yeah.
Yeah, they have some demos, which are really cool. Their neural networks are basically doing something called deep stereo, which takes two or more Google Street View images sequences and processes those to kind of put you into that space in a virtual way. Basically, what it's doing, it's analyzing the view from multiple angles, from each of those images, and then it approximates how the room or that view looks at different angles throughout the room that there was no picture taken from. Depth, color of every pixel in each of these images is analyzed. That creates a 3D space. Then it fills in the gaps from the original photos based on color and depth input. And we're looking at it right now. This is kind of like a walkthrough based on, you know, up in the top right corner, the images that pieced it together. And then when you look at the whole thing, it's just this smooth kind of virtual, virtual walkthrough that's just really, really cool.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready.
Put that in your cardboard.
There you go.
In your OnePlus cardboard.
OnePlus cardboard.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Never settle.
Mm-hmm. When did you get that?
It just came yesterday.
Nice. Very nice.
There's no forehead grease.
And there's no OnePlus 2 in there, I'm assuming,
no,
right?
No.
Oh, well, that's a bummer.
It took me some time to figure out what is happening here. But they have two images that are at slightly different angles. And then this technology is creating all the images in between, like guessing what the images in between would look like and then stitching them together. Well, it's incredible, and the place that I want to see it is where I think the worst user experience is in Google Maps, which is when you go down a street view and you want to walk up the block, you have to click and click and click. I just want to hold down my mouse, you know, and then kind of zoom down the block, right? Because you're always like a couple, you kind of want to see what's in the couple blocks where you are, and it's a total pain. Like this Lombard Street movement here, like that's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It's got that surreal feeling to it.
Floaty, dreamy.
Does the world as material design.
Kind of like, I'm going to throw up in a minute. Yeah. Kind of look.
Yeah, I'm not sure you want to put this in cardboard.
Yeah, I'm sure this will get better. But so can they do this with other, so this is one person's photo, like a bunch of photographs from one person, right? I mean,
yeah.
Could they do this with like crowdsource it, like with a bunch of different people's photographs?
Well,
on the same day
that.
Or in the same time period?
Like a tourist attraction where tons and tons of photos. I mean, the key is getting enough of the photos, right?
Right.
Well, I think they don't need that many.
Yeah, they can start. I mean, they can begin to do it with two images. Obviously, you're probably not going to get this motion thing, which what you're seeing there is the sequence of pictures as it travels along the path. But, but yeah, it currently takes 12 minutes to produce a single 512 by 512 image. Mm. So it's pretty slow, and apparently it's pretty costly. So they don't imagine this is something that we're going to see in use anytime soon, but it's kind of the start of something cool.
Go Moore's Law.
Yes, exactly.
Jack down the frame rate and kind of, even if you make kind of small images and then a couple of years and things get faster, we'll see this. Just maybe not just right now.
Yeah, I have a feeling like it, well, like I'm trying to think if they would be able to do something this impressive based on like different people's photographs of a landmark from different times of year or whatever, and I'm not sure it would be quite the same thing. Because it's not building
different. Yeah.
Like more like a time lapse.
It would almost, I would imagine, then be like an approximation of the two, you know, for all of the images in between.
Yeah, even if they were taken like years apart or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Since we have some other maps news here, we might as well talk about it. You remember way back when Google's Map Maker was, I don't know, let's just say some people had a little too much fun with Google's Map Maker and vandalized it more or less. Well, Google, I guess, kind of shut that down a while ago, and they're ready to reopen the Map Maker. And this time they're emphasizing kind of a community moderation approach to control all that chaos as opposed to hiring staffers to do it. Qualified regional leads are going to be sought out. Google still plans to approve some edits, although we don't really know exactly what edits Google would approve. But so basically MapMaker will be coming back, but this time community moderated. Is that the right way to go?
Yeah, I think it was like a pretty popular feature. I mean, I think they should bring it back. And yeah, community moderate makes a lot of sense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not to bring up Reddit, but sometimes it works. But it does work most of the time where, you know, people will step in and say, no, you can't do that. Maybe a better example is Wikipedia. Well, most of the time that works. Yeah. No, I think this is a good way to go. I'm making jokes, but yeah, I think they do a good job. And I think people get really into maps. I mean, there are some people that just really go nuts over map and map technology. And so I think this is a good answer to the problem.
Yeah.
Did you guys talk, by the way, about the updates to the Map app last week?
Oh, I think I grabbed that for my tip. We can talk about it now.
Sorry.
It's okay. No, that's okay. All right, we'll save it for later.
Yeah, let's save it.
That's a tease, ladies and gentlemen.
I didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I shamelessly stole it from the middle of the rundown. So
don't you go stealing Gina's tip?
Oh, but this, I think yours is different. I think yours is different. I'm talking about the UI. How you can make the UI disappear.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
So what is that? I think I read something about that.
In the most recent Maps update for Android, if that's been pulled down to your device, I can actually probably even show it. So if you see the usually you get the little buttons. I have to look backwards here. The little buttons in the Google bar at the top. And with the latest one, if you just touch it, they disappear. Oh, so it gives you a full view of the map. And if you want to bring it back, you just touch it again, or just move it around or something. Double tap. I don't know how to get
it back.
You're
gone forever. You're never going to get it back.
Yeah, now I can't get it. I can't put in my... There we go. I touched it the right way that time. Now you can touch it again. It'll come back so you can look stuff up.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a brilliant... Like, sometimes these little... Like, there's some developer out there that says, I've got an idea. Why don't we just make the user interface disappear so people can see the map better?
Mm-hmm.
Duh. So, thought that was cool.
Yeah, that's nice, especially when it's about hiding the Google search bar, right? Which is, which is not always.
You don't usually get an opportunity to hide that,
you know? And I just sort of accept that stuff as like, well, it's the Google product. Like, it's their search bar. It's going to stay there.
Right.
But I think this is the user-centric thing that Pachai was talking about, right?
Yep.
Right. Well, that's maps for Android. Speaking of Android, 10 years ago, by the way, this is a quick one, Google bought Android Inc. for $50 million. It's been 10 years already.
I can't believe that.
That's crazy. Yeah. It's been 10 years. So it was 05. Oh, man. That's crazy.
And I mean, Android was a lot different before it ever even launched to the public. You know, it was not even, I don't even think, a touchscreen interface in 2005. It was more meant to look kind of like a BlackBerry approach than anything. So it changed a lot even before it even, you know, hit the hands of consumers.
But did they buy the technology or the staff more?
10 years. I thought they bought the staff because Andy Rubin was part of that.
Yeah,
and Andy Rubin came over and, you know, ended up being kind of a rock star at Google for quite a while. He's done at Google now, so he's not at Google anymore. But
so I've been trying to buy, I'm trying to look for Android Auto.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So Android Auto.
Android Auto. So my car is dying. 185,000 miles, dings, it's dying. So I need to get a car. I have three requirements. I won't fit them all. Believe it or not, I need four-wheel drive because I live on hills with snow and I got to have that. I wanted a hybrid and I wanted Android Auto. So I go to a bunch of dealers. I look at the list that was announced at I.O. There's a huge number of, you know, it's not Toyota, which is what I have now. It's not Ford, but it's Chevy. It's other places. So I go to these places and I talk to this car salesman. Android what? What's that?
Oh, no.
Every single case. No idea whatsoever. Then I go to Hyundai, which has the Hyundai Sonata as the first car out with it. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, yeah, Android thing. Yeah. I said, when's it going to hit the other cars? You know? So then I went last night to Audi, and apart from the fact that the sales guy kept calling it Android Audio, all right, not being critical here, but there was a guy who really knew his stuff, and so I just thought, I didn't know this, maybe you guys knew this, but he said, as far as he understood, what's going to happen is that the cars that have the right equipment at Audi, it'll just be a patch that'll run.
Yep.
So that made me imagine that I'm going to treat my car just like we all treat our phones. You know, update. I'll be driving all the time. Are you ready for an update yet? Trying to get it. But I'm hoping that I can get Android Auto assured in a car. We'll see. Do you guys know anything about this?
Well, you don't want to go the aftermarket route. I've been looking at the Pioneer units. That's what I was going to do, is just get one of those aftermarket Pioneer units, slap it in there, and be good to go.
My car is so near death. 11 years old.
And if you're going to get a new car, you want it built in.
Yeah, you want it all. Yeah, exactly.
I do. My car to know me.
Not pieced together. Yeah, are you going to get
still thinking. I'm seriously
$700 one? Or
I'm kind of waiting to see. I'm kind of waiting to see if they go like the next version and maybe it's $600 or $500. $700 is just a lot to play for basically a stereo. But
resistive
we'll see.
Screen on those as well, know, unless you upgrade. But actually, I think it was Phil Nickenson of Android Central. He was in for All About Android a couple of months ago, a little while ago anyways. And he was playing around with it. And he actually said the resistive screen, believe it or not, on a device like Android Auto actually really works well. Because, you know, resistive screen, like you got to kind of punch it anyways. And that's how you do things on your dash. You don't like lightly tap like you do on a touch phone, you know, a touch screen phone for things. And so you really don't even notice that it's resistive. So. Yeah.
And the other thing I've been thinking about, to be honest, is just taking my wife's old Nexus 7 that she doesn't use anymore and going that route, just hacking it up. It's more fun for me anyway. So
yeah, you like
I might
to
do that.
Things.
I do.
And then you're on the hook for support, so
just
keep that in mind. But maybe you enjoy that, too.
I do. At least for myself, not for all my friends.
The fourth remote control, switch the input, and then move to the second remote control. No, that the other second remote control.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I had that experience this morning with my nine-year-old. Dad, the TV's not working. What'd you do? Well, you got to use this remote and then punch this button and then set it to setting 2, and it'll work. Don't you know that by now? You're 9 years old.
You don't know this by now?
Yeah.
Going back to what you were saying, Jeff, as far as updating the Android Auto. So basically, updating Android Auto in the dash would then be done using your phone as kind of the data access point and transferring that data over? Is that how it's done?
Or no, I think that the car company will send a patch to the hardware in the car itself so that will then enable Android Auto with your phone.
I see.
That was my sense.
So you have to take it into them to do that?
I would bet so, yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, over the air updates on the computer inside my car. That just sounds like you're asking for trouble on something like that.
You could do that, right? With the,
I imagine you could.
The car. What's that? What's that popular app you can get with a little dongle for your car's thing? What's the name of it? I can't remember.
Yeah, I forgot.
Chat room will help us out with that. But they actually enable that. They enable you to connect through your phone and get updates over the air and stuff while you're driving.
Kind of. My car is so old. How old is it, Jeff? It's so old. It doesn't have an aux plug.
Oh yeah, I know that feel.
Drives me nuts. So I have a cassette adapter. I've gone through 20 of them.
Oh, those cassette adapters.
Yes.
I had this really That's old awesome. Car and had to buy one of those cassette adapters. And the guy at Best Buy was literally like handed it to me, looked disgusted, and was like, "You really need to get a better car. Like, you shouldn't be buying this anymore."
I'm disgusted that I have to sell this to you.
Yeah, he was really angry that he had to dig it up out of the stock in the back. It was just like, you need a better car.
When they sell it, when those salespeople sell somebody a cassette deck, I think they're actually dinged in their paycheck for that they didn't like upgrade you to a CD deck at least or something with an aux input. My car is a 2005, and it has the stereo that's embedded with the stereo and the air conditioner and all that are all in one single unit, so you can't replace it.
Wow.
It's only a CD player. There's no aux input. So what I had to do, I actually had to buy a kit, pull out the stereo, and hack into the CD line. And so I have a blank CD that plays in the CD player and a cord that I've fused into it, fed out the side. So I have aux now, but it's a total hack job. But it works.
And you have to play the blank CD. That's amazing.
Blank CD on repeat. 80-minute blank CD. And
that's
and it
the
works.
CD version of the cassette adapter.
It totally
that's
is.
Incredible.
It totally is.
You know, this is my argument for design thinking. In the secrecy of the auto industry. If they listen, my car's 11 years old, but we had Walkmen then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had things that I wanted to plug in then, but they didn't listen to customers. You know, for a 39-cent plug, they could have made people happy.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you don't buy a car without an auxiliary input, but.
Well, that's why I don't want to buy a car without Android Auto.
Yeah. Might as well start off.
Here's my fear about Android Auto. My fear is it's going to be so safetied up that it will be less useful than my phone just hanging there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it has Android Auto, does that mean that it doesn't have an auxiliary input?
Oh, no. It'll have that, too.
It'll have that, too. So you can still use it the way you use it right now.
Yeah. It'd be like a mode.
In worst case scenario.
Yeah, you go this mode. You hit the mode button until it got to Android Auto.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and I think this way you can get your own tweets and your own destinations. Here's the other problem. I'm an addict, as you know, of Waze. Waze is not ported to Android Auto yet. It's just Google Maps. I'm not a Google Maps guy. I'm a Waze guy. This could be trouble. These could be future complaints on the show. We'll just see.
Stay tuned to find out.
I'm a Google Maps guy, and I've got to say that Google's been doing a good job at incorporating a lot of the Waze technology into Google Maps lately. Over the past couple months, the turn-by-turn directions, and now it comes on and says you are on the fastest route to your destination, or if you're not, it'll say you can get there 6 minutes faster.
I love that.
Or I think it says, "Would you like to save 6 minutes on your trip or something?" It's like, "Yes, of course."
I've had
software updates for your routes. Yeah,
that's awesome.
I've literally had half an hour saved.
Yeah,
driving through San Francisco because of one of those that came up when I was late and I got there early. I was
the other night. we were coming home from We were coming home from the Taylor Swift concert.
Oh, you're a good dad. You're a good dad.
She's amazing. She's girl power, man. She's all girl power.
Yeah. She gets this a great show, I've heard.
She does. She really does. It's quite amazing. You'll be in whatever her equivalent is in about 12 years, Gina.
Yeah.
And so I always turn on Waze because I actually think it's a generous social act to add my data in return for all the data I get. But sometimes when I'm going the way home, I'm so on automatic myself, I don't notice. I just noticed that, it's telling me to get off way before it ever tells me to get off. And I did. I always listen to the Waze lady. Always listen to the Waze lady. And there was a terrible accident. The entire highway was shut down. People were stuck there for 3 hours.
Wow.
Ooh.
Wow. Waze probably saved me with two teenage girls in the car.
Oh, could you imagine?
3 hours.
Jacked up on Taylor Swift.
Exactly.
Singing all those songs.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that's the challenge, right? Is when you're driving a route that you've driven a million times And you use a navigation because you just want to know how long it's going to take to get there. And then suddenly it pipes in and says, actually, go this way and you'll save blah, blah, blah. And I have to like, I have to actively trust in Google at that point. Like, because my instant reaction is, no, I've done this a million times. I know how this goes.
I'm telling you, Jason, I have learned the lesson.
No, I totally
every
have.
Single time I've had the hubris to disobey the ways lady,
yep.
I have regretted it.
Yep. It's true.
So great.
And by the way, I feel you on Taylor Swift. Because my daughter has discovered Taylor Swift, too. Okay. Anyways, sorry about that.
I got to say, there were geek moments in it because the stage, it has the runway. I think, okay, runway, she's going to come out. And we were on the floor of the stadium. So we were near the thing. The runway came up. I thought, well, that's cool. It came way up, moved back, moved around, and she was on the edge. And so she manages to talk to the cheap seats all around. It's phenomenal.
Oh, that's great.
That's awesome. She's pretty amazing. My Nexus 6 camera did not work at all well in the conditions.
Oh, yeah. The lighting, right? In those situations. Lighting's a problem.
I put in one where she looks like she's just an apparition because the light on her is so bright, everything around. So it's just this white silhouette.
Yeah.
And then also the poor Nexus 6 couldn't do it. But nonetheless, Taylor Swift is okay.
Speaking of camera, I don't know if any of you, it's not in the rundown, but it just kind of reminded me of this. Marques Brownlee on YouTube, he got a hold of the OnePlus 2. He's not showing it. He's not showing it off. So he obviously has something going with the OnePlus folks. They gave him a OnePlus 2. He shot a video on like camera performance, like just a bunch of pictures that he took and everything. And pictures look so. But this is kind of my way to segue into asking you guys, like, are you excited about the OnePlus 2? Is anyone here going to get it, do you think? What are your thoughts? Where do we stand on OnePlus at this point?
Because Gina's is broken. Gina has OnePlus 1. And the question is she going the Nexus route or the OnePlus route this time? That's what I want to hear.
Yeah, no, it's tough. I'm still using the OnePlus 1. The buttons broke, so I had to turn on actually the software buttons. So now I'm using those. That's fine.
At least there's a fallback for that.
Yeah.
But they broke?
Yeah, like my daughter dropped it and then the capacitive button stopped. Like the capacitive buttons just stopped registering taps.
Got
so
it.
Like I had no button, no back, no nothing. So I was like, what am I going to do? So I factory reset it and there was, it was an option in the beginning. Like, do you want to turn on software buttons? And I was like, oh yeah, the software buttons.
Yeah, and you can do that in settings
sort of
as well.
Nice save, because otherwise I would have had to buy a new phone. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a really good experience with the OnePlus 1, but I had to wait so long for Lollipop. And I feel like out of touch with the sort of pure Google experience, even with the Cyanogen. I mean, I love Cyanogen and the extra controls. I don't like that OnePlus is like diverged now. There's Oxygen. It's Oxygen, right?
Yep.
Oxygen and Cyanogen. I think they're going to push Oxygen, which I just don't know a whole lot about yet. And I think I'm ready to sort of get back on the Nexus train. That said, like, I'm not like all fired up about the Nexus 6 either. I kind of want the next Nexus, whatever that is. And I'm sort of hoping that by the end of the year.
Well, there's rumors of two of them coming out. One with Huawei. And one 5.7 inch screen, says the rumor, and one more like a 5 inch screen with, was it LG, I think?
Yeah.
That would be great. I would do that.
If that happens
by the end of the year, I would do that. You know, that's interesting. The Huawei partnership would be really interesting, right? Because what's his head from the Android team, right? Went to Huawei.
No, you're thinking of Xiaomi. Hugo Barra.
He went to Xiaomi.
Different. I don't know when that would ever happen, but
I totally
that would be pretty
thing,
intense.
I slated the two companies because it's like two companies whose names are like hard for me to say.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So you said a 5.7 and a 5. I probably do the 5.7.
5.7, yeah, I think so. So I couldn't go back to a tiny phone.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't know. I have to think about that.
But
I could go, this is 5.5. I could maybe try to go a little smaller. I might go for the smaller one again. I don't know.
My wife's in the market for a phone, so I don't know if I can hold off till Google announces their next phone, though. But it's hard to find the Nexus 5s. And, you know,
more.
Seems like they're not getting as many updates lately for the Nexus 5. So, I don't know. It seems like Google's maybe shying away a little bit from the Nexus 5. So, we'll see. I don't know. I'd like to keep her in the Nexus family because it's just so much easier to troubleshoot problems and fix things. And, you know, she's got the latest update. I don't have to worry about, you know, going and downloading a ROM for her. So we'll see what happens. I really like my Nexus 6, though. I have no complaints. I mean, this is one of the first phones where, number one, I've not had to load a custom ROM on it, which is great. And I've had almost no problems at all with it. The only thing, the only problem I had was not Google's fault. It was not Motorola's fault. It was AT&T's fault because they loaded a really obnoxious splash screen thing. When it comes up, it would display the AT&T logo.
Oh, okay.
And it would set the volume for 100% and
for
play,
that.
Yes, just for that. Yeah, and it was crazy. Yeah. And so, like, even at work, there's no way to mute it. So I'd, like, reboot my phone at work, and it would be like, ding, 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 ding. Like, I was like, everybody's looking like, what's going on? So that's the only complaint I have with AT&T, but not with the phone. I love it.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I like my 6 after breaking the first phone. I don't blame the 6 for that, by the way. I just wasn't wearing a case.
I would love to have a USB-C, but I think that'll be coming to everything soon.
I think that that's going to be – my call is that that's going to be in both of the Nexuses, if there are, in fact, two Nexuses, which would be kind of weird if Google suddenly does a two Nexus release because they haven't done that before. But there's a first for everything, I suppose. But I think Google kind of at this point has already kind of made it pretty clear that they recognize USB-C as the kind of next standard for mobile.
Well, it's on my Pixel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. They have it on the Pixel.
So I got the new Chromebook Flip.
All right. So let's talk about that.
So one of it's really sweet. But I thought the DC is – you can't see it, but the DC is very small. And the plug, I thought – USB charging on this is not a C, but it's USB. I thought that's great. No, it's not. It's just it fools you how small it is. But this is I got a review unit. So FTC trying to make very clear here what it is. Nice, sweet little unit. And of course, it swivels back. The keyboard then goes off, and it's now a tablet with touchscreen. The thing that strikes, so it's a very nice little unit. It's light. It's small. You know, I compare this with carrying around a tablet with a keyboard. This is much better than that. What I haven't got my head around yet is the problem of Chrome versus Android. That Chrome is still not built, even though I use touchscreen on my Pixel, to use Chrome as a touchpad device. The X is a little small. It's a little bit difficult. It misses you occasionally just because Chrome's not really built for that kind of touch, you know, general touch use. It's supplementary rather than the whole of touch use. So I find that interesting. You know, and I wonder whether they're going to start merging Chrome and Android finally more. We've speculated about that in this show for ages, ever since Sundar got both under him. But this is a really nice little sweet machine, and I'm playing with it. I carried it as my only machine today when I went into the city. I'm going to try to work it as my main machine for a week or so and see what I think. But I got one from Asus to try out, and I like it.
Nice.
So that's all.
How much is the Flip? It's like what, a couple
that's
$100?
$339, I think, something like that.
Okay.
No, maybe that's too high. No, that's the problem where you see somebody on Amazon listed as, you know, one seller sells it and it's like an eBay bad deal. I'm not sure what the price is. Actually,
yeah, I want to say it's like a couple hundred dollars. It's not
a couple hundred bucks.
It's not an expensive.
No, it's not one expensive. I mean, you consider that if you bought a Nexus 9 and a keyboard, that'd cost a lot more than this.
$249 for the 2 gig of RAM model. $299 for the 4 gig.
Okay, model. $299. Right. So I would always with Chrome always get 4 gig, folks. Don't get 2 gig.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Now on Chrome, you can download movies. Or shows or whatever, you can download Google Play stuff into the machine so I can watch it. Will the experience be as good? I don't know. I'm going to try it on this versus, I mean, I carry my Nexus 7 everywhere. I don't carry a keyboard for it. I also carry the Chromebook. Here's the question. If I carried that, would that get rid of, you know, now I carry both a tablet and a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
As insane as that is. Would this one machine replace that? I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I think it kind of falls back on, is the tablet version of that one machine as good as what you get out of running an Android tablet?
Yes.
And I would agree with you. Like, if all I had was the screen of this Pixel and not the keyboard, I'm not sure that I could live my life like that in the Chrome universe. It's a touchscreen device, but it's not touch first. And as a result, like you say, like a lot of the touch points are really small and sometimes a little finicky and everything. But it's nice. It's a nice option to have for certain random things. So,
And the other thing I got to say, you know, and this is me, my Chromebook love, year and a half on Chromebooks. But to get a new machine, put in my ID, and I'm on, and everything that I have is there in a minute. Literally,
yeah,
a minute.
Yeah, that's really nice.
It's
that's
phenomenal. Really nice. Mm-hmm.
What if when you flipped it over, it just went into Android mode?
Popped into Android tablet.
You had access kind of, to all the same files?
I mean, I don't know. I think this is kind of what we're talking about as far as like the eventual convergence of Chrome and Android. Because like if a Chromebook or Chrome OS really is just kind of like the Chrome browser, but, you know, on steroids, you know, as in an OS sort of environment, why couldn't that be done inside of Android or in some sort of way where they work seamlessly together? And in that case, that would be pretty rocking, I would say.
That'd be pretty cool.
Because undoubtedly, at least in my experience, the Chromebook is a much better productivity device than Android is with a keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yep. Yes.
You know what I mean? So. Like I could commit myself to Chrome OS and have it be my computer for the most part. Now that I'm not video editing and stuff, like I can probably safely do that. But I could not commit myself to Android with a keyboard, an Android tablet with a keyboard. Like the Dell Venue 10-7000, I reviewed it a couple of weeks ago on Before You Buy, and it is exactly that. And it's probably the best one for Android right now, the best convertible tablet, you know, with a keyboard dock that's running Android. But I couldn't live my life like that. That couldn't be my one and only device.
Yeah.
It could work for some people, but it wouldn't work for me.
Go ahead, Gina.
I was going to say, just like we've seen Android and Chrome sort of dancing around one another, right? You can run Chrome on Android. You can run Android on Chrome, right? In that one crazy extension. It doesn't seem that crazy, right? That one machine will be able to switch between the two of them. And that is what I'd want. I definitely want the Android interface. That said, I don't use the Chromebook. I don't use the Pixel as much. So I'm not quite used to Chrome with a touch, you know, with the touch interface, but yeah, I imagine those X's are small and it's a little funny. My wife uses the Pixel full time and I was using my MacBook and I handed it to her cause you know, to do something. Cause I needed her to do something on my screen. And she was like, how do I scroll here? Like she didn't know. She went to touch the screen and then she was like, how does this work? And I was like, it's two fingers on the trackpad. She's like, I don't know what that means. Like she just didn't get it at all. It's so funny. She's trained, but yeah, Chrome OS to Android flipping back and forth between the two of them would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could just merge into Chrome Droid.
That's kind of where I see it heading.
Yeah,
because I mean, there's still a little bit of a kind of a I don't know, kind of a detachment when you've got two OSs on one single device that you're switching back and forth. Has there ever been an example of that worked seamlessly in a way that everybody applauded and was like, this is how it needs to be done? Or is it always just kind of like, oh, well, yeah, you can do that. It does run Windows and it does run this other OS and you can use it like that. But is it ideal? Like it shares data between those OSs and you want that if you're doing something like this. But is that good
enough? I don't know if there's ever been a successful implementation. Yeah. I think that's the key. That's the key word, successful. It's been done before. I mean, I can switch back and forth. I mean, just look at like even VirtualBox running on my Windows PC or Windows guest in my Linux PC. I mean, I can go to there. I can map the same drive so I get access to the same files and things like that. But I don't think there's really been a successful emerged hybrid device like that that's worked seamlessly.
Right.
And dual booting or virtualization, whatever it is, if it's Bootcamp or if it's VirtualBox or whatever, that's always been an extreme sort of hobbyist thing. I don't know.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've never seen a consumer product do that.
Yeah.
Switch between the two that weren't really kind of niche specialized, you know, products that didn't go that far. So,
but I would say Google's in the best place to do it with Android and Chrome OS. I've since the beginning, I've always said it should just be Android. But
I think, Aaron, you're really onto something. That if it could be context sensitive to the UI.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because Chrome does work incredibly well across all devices, right? When I use Chrome on my phone, I use it on my laptop. I use it on machine, right? It knows it's me. It works well. It does things. So they got that down. Android does some stuff really, really well. Right? For my constant chronic complaint about multiple user accounts, Android handles well. Mm-hmm. Chrome can't handle with a crap. And so there's good and bad in each. But if you take the use case of saying now you're on a small device, now you're sideways looking at a movie, that's better in Chrome, that's better in Android, you know, whatever it is, to start to pull the best based on your use case. I think there's something to that.
Yeah, and I actually, for a while, I used an Odroid C1. It was kind of like a Raspberry Pi. I was setting up an Odroid C1 with Android on it. And for a while, I had that connected to my monitor at home with keyboard and mouse and everything, just like a normal computer. And I got used to it. And it actually functioned really, really well. And I got so, especially some of the apps like Netflix and YouTube, I preferred using them on Android, even though I had it sitting side by side with my PC. I really did prefer that interface, even on a big screen. It was connected to a, you know, my normal monitor. And so I could use a laptop just with Android running. Maybe I'll try to hack that together and see how that goes. Just run Android instead, just like a Chromebook, but running Android instead of Chrome OS for a while and see how that goes. I've got some old laptops sitting around. Maybe I'll do that. Because I did not find it. When I had the physical keyboard and the physical mouse sitting next to me, I did not find it unpleasant. And there was almost nothing I couldn't do. And like Jeff said, there were some things like multiple user accounts that Android actually handled better than a desktop or Chrome OS did that I preferred. Mm-hmm. So
let's see here. I thought this was kind of cool. So Google launched Nearby. It's an API that basically empowers developers to allow their apps to talk to each other based on a location context, essentially proximity. And you know, Google's done a lot to kind of make this simple for the developers, of course. And by the way, this is the same thing that you see with Chromecast guest mode, which, you know, now through this is available to all developers. Along with this, Google also launched Eddystone, which is a open source cross-platform Bluetooth LE beacon. So, you know, we could essentially do things like the minute you walk into the Twit studio, we could have a beacon that shoots the Twit schedule to your device just based on proximity alone. So Google launched this yesterday, and all existing Bluetooth or beacon hardware could actually be updated. The firmware could be updated to support this right away, since it's just Bluetooth support Eddystone. So this is kind of Google's kind of bigger picture, you know, a piece of the bigger puzzle of kind of the Internet of Things when it comes to what Google's working on in that world. Kind of cool. Have you guys had – so I asked this last night on All About Android, and I'm very curious from a user standpoint. Have any of you used iOS and experienced the iBeacon?
I haven't, but when I visited China and I was in the airport for the first time, my phone just lit up and started beeping, you know, I started getting notifications saying, do you want to accept this Bluetooth message? And I was literally just like passing kiosks or ads – and they were ads, you know, for things, offers, whatever. And it was the first time. This is a long time ago on like a Nokia candy bar phone. This is a while ago, if I'm remembering that correctly. But I remember being like, oh, this is weird and intrusive because I just got hammered with so many of them kind of at the same time. But thinking about it, you know, I mean, I ride the bus a couple of days a week, and I'm walking to the bus stop and I'm pulling up City Mapper and I'm saying, what's the schedule? Like, I would love to arrive at the bus stop and just have the schedule pushed, you know, like next bus 2 minutes away. Mm-hmm. That would be great, right? And I mean, I'm standing at a bus stop. Like, that's clearly information I want to have. So I'm definitely open to this if it's done well, like we talked about earlier, like if the notifications are wanted notifications. If I worked at the Brick House and I got the schedule, like, you know, buzzing in my pocket every day that I came into work, that might annoy me. So, but I'm sure there are ways to say, like, okay, I got this, you know, don't send this to me again.
Yeah, I mean, you could always just turn off Bluetooth, I suppose, but that's kind of like an all or nothing approach. Yeah, because you might want this, but every time I walk into Twit, I don't need to know the schedule. I live the schedule.
Right, you live this. You are the schedule, Jason.
I live within the schedule. It's okay. You don't need to tell me when I walk in the door. Yeah, that was my main question. Is like, this is really cool, and I'm sure that this is something that we're going to see a lot more of. Kind of this beacon technology. Thankfully, iBeacon, like I said, iBeacon hardware, it doesn't take much for that to also support this Eddystone, which is Google's beacon service. So
I'm really anxious to look.
I don't know. I wonder
this.
How intrusive it would be in practice.
I don't know about intrusiveness, but I'm really – I mean, when they first started talking about this at Google I/O, I was really interested in it because – in the Bluetooth – type notification style is actually really interesting. At our makerspace, we're putting together all kinds of different things that people just want to hack on. One of the ideas that somebody had is, okay, if I'm working on a project, maybe I have a little button I press near where the project is or that represents that project. Mm-hmm. And then it tweets out to all the other members of the makerspace, hey, I'm working on this CNC project right now. If you want to come join me, you know, come on down and we'll work on it together. Or I'm working on a Raspberry Pi project, you know, just because you want to let people know, but you want an easy way to do it. I don't want to get out my phone. I mean, this seems like something really simple for that. The other thing that we're working on is when you come in the door, you scan your RFID card and it tells you things like, oh, this is your 100th visit to the makerspace. And you were last working on the blah, blah, blah project and things like that. And just some fun things to keep people engaged. So so I'm really interested in learning more about this for sure as it develops, because right now I'm doing all that programming in Python and using JSON and making calls to update, push updates to browsers and things. Maybe this is an easier way to do it.
Yeah. Right. This is almost like an automatic QR code.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly
what
it is. Right?
Exactly.
Death to the QR code.
I know. That's what I hear. Meanwhile, I continue to use QR codes on all about Android. Sorry, all you QR haters. So Google Photos, I don't know if you guys heard about this, but there was kind of a thing that happened over the weekend where somebody had a Google Photos app installed for a very brief amount of time, then uninstalled it and noticed a while later that photos were still being uploaded. Even though the app wasn't installed, it was still syncing photos to the cloud. Cue hysteria as people claim that Google is doing this on purpose to slurp as much of your data as possible. And I suppose we don't actually know the answer to that question, but the answer lies in Google Play services. So basically what this is Google Photos was essentially a front end, a conduit for enabling you to use that service of syncing all of your photos to the cloud. But what it's actually doing is it's actually changing that setting inside Google Play services, which is a different settings pane on your phone entirely. So yes, that is pretty darn confusing. When you uninstall the Photos app, it doesn't automatically deselect the sync. That's still a service that's running, and you have to actually know to turn that off. So not sure if it was an oversight on Google's part. Google did say that they're looking to address that, and specifically to kind of clarify the communication of that. Like maybe when you go to uninstall Google Photos, it gives you a notification, right, or something like that. Although I don't know how it could do that, because when you uninstall an app, I've never uninstalled an app from my app tray and had it like ask me a question before I hit OK.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just says,
not,
do you want to uninstall it? OK.
Yeah,
so
I'm not
I don't know
sure
how you do that.
If you can do that. That's interesting. I mean, Photos is a web app, right? Like you go to photos.google.com and your photos are there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's an argument for like, well, this is a setting, whether or not you have, this is a system-wide setting, whether or not you have the Photos app installed. But that's a very nuanced, like that's not something users should know.
Right.
Totally. And it does seem like a prompt, as you uninstall, mm-hmm, would be appropriate. But I don't think I've ever seen that either, so I'm not sure if that's possible.
Yeah, I don't know if it is. I know that there's more to talk about. We do have to thank another sponsor of today's episode, so let's do that real quick, and then we can kind of come back. And I'm curious if there's stuff in here. We've got a lot that we haven't touched on yet, so I'll kind of leave it in your hands. Take a look at the rundown, and if you find something you really want to talk about, hold it in your memory bank, and we'll get back to it here in a second. In the meantime, I want to take a minute to thank another sponsor of today's episode. That is LegalZoom. I've been a LegalZoom user for years. Shortly before we had our first daughter, we used LegalZoom basically to do our living will and testament, and it was just an awesome experience, super easy. We have it sealed away, and we're just really happy with it. So I'm stoked to have them on the network, and there are a lot of reasons just outside of like my personal reason to use it. Also, it's fantastic for business. Smart business people are trusting LegalZoom. It'll help you incorporate or form an LLC to start your own business if you're thinking about starting one, or form a nonprofit. You can also register a trademark to protect your products, your services using LegalZoom. And you can apply for a patent. And that way you can secure your awesome invention. Over the past decade, more than a million people just like you have started with LegalZoom. And it's your first stop when you need advice from an attorney. This is something that they started not long ago. Now, LegalZoom's not a law firm, so they built a network of independent attorneys in most states to provide legal advice. as well as other useful services to help you run your business. So they kind of tap into that knowledge. Whether you need a contract reviewed or advice on whether you should incorporate or form an LLC, whatever your legal question happens to be, you can start with LegalZoom. They can provide complete transparency, upfront pricing, customer reviews, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. So make the smart choice, make the right choice for your business at LegalZoom.com today. And don't forget to enter TWIG at checkout to save even more. That's LegalZoom.com, promo code TWIG. Legal help is here and starts with LegalZoom. Check it out for yourself. And we thank LegalZoom for their continued support of This Week in Google and the TWIT Network. All right, so we got a bunch of stuff in here. You guys got something you want to talk about? Is there something in here that's just jumping out at you?
Can we talk about the Commodore PET?
I wondered if someone would catch on to that.
Yeah.
I think we should. I think it's imperative.
Yeah.
What
so
do you think?
I think we have to. So I saw this yesterday. In fact, you may have seen this. Did you post this yesterday on Google Plus?
I did.
Okay. So that's where I saw it. If you're a fan of Commodore 64, or just the Commodore company in general, you may want to check out the Commodore PET. No, not the old Commodore PET. The new Commodore PET. It's a smartphone coming soon to a store near you, especially if you're in Europe. I guess Europe's getting them first. But I guess Commodore, the company that bought the right to use the name Commodore, is coming out with a phone, and it's a reasonably spec'd phone, and they're going to call it the Commodore PET. So good for them. I mean, it made me kind of want to buy one. it's not a bad looking phone. If you look at the pictures in the story, this is from a story from Wired. Did this story actually? If you're following along, or you want to look it up, and they kind of go over the history of Commodore and why they're able to call this a Commodore phone. But it's not a bad phone. I mean, it's got a NVIDIA graphics, iOS 2 graphics, Intel Atom processor, 4 gigs of RAM, terabyte of storage. Oh, wait. No, that's the Commodore 64X. I was like, wait a second. What? That's the wrong paragraph.
That's amazing. A terabyte of
storage. Let me go down to the next paragraph where I was supposed to be looking. Here we go. 1.7 gigahertz MediaTek 64-bit octa-core processor with a Mali GPU.
And extra storage with a cassette deck.
Deck and a cassette deck adapter for an aux port.
If by cassette deck you mean micro SD card, then you are correct.
300 milliamp battery, 13 megapixel camera with 2.0 f-stop aperture, videos up to 1080p. So it's not like the super high end, but it's a high enough end that I would consider buying it for sure.
It is MediaTek.
It's not historically the best, but it may work okay. Now, here's the cool part, though, right? Here's the cool part, and then I'll let other people jump in because I'm excited about this. It comes with two Commodore emulators.
Yeah.
Standard on the phone. So you can emulate Commodore 64 and you can emulate Amiga on the phone when it comes out. And I think that's just awesome. I mean, that was like the icing on the cake, right? Not only is it called Commodore, but I can actually run Commodore emulators on it. I think I may have to buy this.
And I mean, mind you, it's not difficult to find Commodore emulators for Android.
Right.
You can do that.
You can find it.
You can do that on any phone. But it's just kind of cool that they're embracing that.
I don't know how much of this is true. In the article, it says they're customized versions of these emulators. And it says the team's also working with unnamed software houses to bring some of the 80s best games on the PET before shipping. So there may be, they may actually run a little better. Yeah,
because
I don't know.
How many of those software houses are still kind of around to work deals with?
Yeah, this may just be what they're saying publicly. And then behind the scenes, they're just downloading those same emulators that we would download and getting the same games from the same websites that we would get them from and just loading them on there. But still, very, very exciting, I think. Cost on this rumored to be between $300 and $365, depending on if you go with less RAM or more RAM, 16 or 32 gigs of RAM. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. I think the name is really appealing to me, and I love that they're embracing the emulator side of things, because I think it would be, in retrospect, knowing that they are doing that, it would be kind of strange if they didn't. It would be like, okay, so it's a phone with a Commodore logo.
Right.
So that kind of makes more sense.
Yeah.
Having said that, I mean, it is, just to kind of come back down to earth a little bit, Commodore today is not the Commodore then. This is absolutely one of those situations where somebody bought the trademark and is just like, well, let's okay, let's just release a phone then with the logo, and people are going to love it because of that. So I totally get it. I kind of feel kind of ridiculous for wanting it because of that. But at the same time, it does have Commodore on there, and I was a Commodore nut, so it tugs.
I want the trash 80 phone.
Yes. Me too. Me too. I'm right with you. I wish I could get
one. You know what I want? No, I take it all back. Take it back. You know what I want? What I desperately want? I want the Osborne 1.
I think what this has made me realize is there is a market for retro machines.
Oh, yeah.
But totally. Like a phone's built to look like retro machines.
Yeah.
Like this kind of needs to happen, I think.
There is. My former coworker, Andy Bayo, did this talk about how he had a son and his son was 4 years old and he wanted his son to like experience video games in the same order that he did. So he bought one of those little handheld controllers that had like Pong and like the first generation of video games, and his son played through those, and then he got the second generation, and he got his son basically the games that he played in his lifetime, you know, in the order that he played them. And it was so great. I think it was a talk. It's online, but in the video, you know, I saw so many games that like I was like, oh yeah, I loved Adventure. Like I remember the way that dragon sounded. It sounded so good. But like I was like, I want this, right? But I'm not a huge gamer. I get that there are emulators, and then you can download ROMs from somewhere, and it's not maybe legal. I don't even really know how that works or like where I would go get those. So I mean, this is kind of like a little bit of a black box for someone like me who like casually games like in the 80s. You know, like I love some of the old games, but like didn't, you know, I haven't taken the time to set it up. Or I was amazed when I went on Amazon and found that you could buy like the old Atari controller that just like hooks into your TV and has like a selection of, you know, whatever, a Pac-Man and the rest of the games on it. Like I just had no idea. So I don't know. There might be a market for like an emulator with a bunch of games that you don't have to do anything funky to get set up or just download anything. I don't even know how many people know what an emulator is. If I talk to my siblings who I gamed with as a kid for years and years, and I said, oh, you need an emulator for that, they would be like, what? Right. You know?
Yeah. I think at that point it's, you know, For folks like that, it's less about you need an emulator and more like you need that phone that plays those games.
Right.
You
know?
Right. Yeah.
Because I mean,
it is a device that pre-installed. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting right next to the guy who built a MAME machine, all around emulation, which, by the way, I am following in your footsteps, and it still continues to scare the living daylights out of me how much planning and preparation it takes to do this.
It is a lot of work.
Not to mention kind of expensive.
Kind of expensive.
I think I thought it was just going to be this quick, like, oh yeah, I'll totally do it. And it's turned into a deal, but I'm doing it. Yeah. I'm committed to it. Yeah. So thank you.
It's
for your help.
$300 or $400 if you want to really do it right. Yeah. So at least. And that's assuming that you recycle old equipment and you build the case yourself and you do all this other stuff, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. What I find interesting about it is, and Gina was just talking about younger people playing. When I brought my the same arcade that I brought here to Twig last time, I brought that down to Maker Faire, and the kids are coming up playing it, and it's a two-player system. So there's two joysticks, two sets of buttons. But inevitably, the kids that were under, I'd say, 10, maybe under 11, they would come up and try to use both joysticks at the same time because they were used to gamepads that have two, you know, like Xbox and PlayStation that have two pads on them.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I was like, it was cracking me up, you know, because they're like, why isn't this working? Like, doesn't this one do this? And it's like, no, you just use that one. And if you're playing Atari, it's just one button. That's it.
It's
joystick,
one button.
Don't touch anything else.
That is fascinating. Yeah, and I do think that there's something to be said. You can speak to the complications of setting up something like that. Just from a system standpoint, you know, particularly when you're talking about something like MAME, there are however many thousands of games, and they all have different controller maps and, you know, different idiosyncrasies that kind of appear. So having a phone that has that all done for you,
there's value to that.
There is,
absolutely.
What else you guys want to talk about? What else have we missed that... that is kind of burning.
You've done a good job.
Have we done our right job?
Covered the bases. This is just a quick story. The fact that Google Drive now you can disable printing, downloading, and copying for any file now in Google Drive. This is just sort of an interesting product thing. So if you're sharing a document, I've created a document. I'm sharing it with Jason. I just want him to look at it. I don't want him to copy it or download it or print it. I can indicate that. Mm-hmm. like, I guess I sort of get that, but it's that weird Snapchat thing where it's like, well, you can't take, you know, you can't save this picture or take a screenshot of it. But of course, anyone could take a photo of the picture or, like, in this case, take a screen grab or copy and paste. It's just kind of one of the, kind of along the lines of the privacy conversation we were having earlier with photos. It's like, you know, that thing of, like, this isn't really locking down the file. It's just making it a little bit harder for someone to copy it or print it or download it. But that's a new option in Google Drive now. You can prevent that.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's not something I had considered needing, but it actually makes perfect sense that you might just want to show somebody.
Yeah, like your share, but
I don't want you to have any sort of control over it. Actually, this one I thought was pretty interesting. It's been 3 years since Google released its spam statistics for Gmail.
Oh.
Last week, they revealed that the spam rate is now... Let me make sure this isn't your number. This isn't your number, right?
No, it's not. No,
okay,
it's not.
They revealed that the spam rate is now down to 0.1% in Gmail. And they're crediting their neural networks that basically better recognize junk and phishing emails and then dynamically create new rules as patterns emerge.
If only they would recognize PR people.
That is true. Yes. Fair enough. But I will say, for the most part,
it's a lifesaver. Lifesaver. Yeah. Amazing.
It's kind of crazy.
I get the ones, I don't know if you guys get these now, I get a lot of them that have just the subject and the email address, and they're it doesn't even seem like they're trying to mask it. It's not phishing. It's just like, you know, call us now to get a new mortgage or something like that. And it's obviously like an email address is from another country, but then the email's blank. Do you get those? Like, I don't know if that's Google, like, you know, taking the body of the email out, or if these are just spammers that are
really bad spammers.
Yeah, just really bad spammers.
They're like, oh man, I forgot. There was no undo send on that one.
Right,
oh, well.
Right. I was like, what? Like, why are you sending me this? Like, at least try.
I mean, I read the subject line. You were halfway there.
I know.
All right, cool. Hey, I think we touched on the good stuff here. Why don't we take a look at some numbers, some tips, some things, all that kind of stuff. Jeff, do you have a number for us?
All right. So I found this interesting. So, of course, watch out. Get ready. Put me in the rundown again to fix what I'm about to say. Now I can't call the story up. Mm-hmm. Hold on. Hold on, folks. So a few years ago, 2004, an Italian-Swedish research team downloaded data from hundreds of online fetish discussion groups and spent 3 years analyzing their haul, says The Guardian. Right there, I'm stopped. 3 years going through this. Right there. It's just amazing to me. But they now have a ranking of fetishes because of this. So I'm sure you can't wait to hear this.
Oh, I think I'm scared.
Yeah, I'm scared.
I think I'm scared to hear this.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Many concerned body parts. Feet and toes lead the list, followed in frequency of order by bodily fluids. I'll let you fill in those blanks. Body size and head hair. The least coveted bits by fetishists are nails, nose, ears, neck. And in last place, I'm very glad to report, body odor. Other fetishes documented by the center are associated with objects on the body. Stockings, skirts, footwear, underwear are the most popular. It eventually dribbles out with some, but few people erotically craving diapers, hearing aids, catheters, and dead last, I'll leave you with this thought, pacemakers. With no idea of what you do with a pacemaker.
I don't know.
That's my little statistical fun for the day. That was a stopper, wasn't it?
Yeah, how do we follow this one up? There is a graphic, like a visualization in this article, and I think I'm afraid to click it. So I'm just going to close the article.
Yeah.
Data.
Okay, there you go. Jabber B went where I was afraid to go. And you can't really see very much, so yay.
Yeah, that's actually good. That's a good zoom level right there.
Let's not zoom in. Yeah, exactly. fascinating stuff, though. I mean, I'm sure there haven't been a whole lot of studies on that to that degree. So let's see here. Gina, you got a tip?
I got
that
something
has, that
really
has
boring.
Maybe nothing to do
beat
with
that,
fetishes.
Beat that.
Boring. Really, really boring. You can look up your local fetish shop. No. My tip is for Google Maps in the browser. When you search for an address, place that you're going later on today, I do this all the time. I'm at my desk, I'm coding, whatever. I look up a place I need to go in Google Maps in my Chrome browser, and then I leave the house, and then I have to look it up again on my phone. Well, in the card now, it's a card. I don't know if this is considered knowledge graph, but when you look up an address in Google Maps in your browser on your desktop, there's a new link in the results that says send to device. You click that, and you can choose one of your Android devices in the list. In my case, I've got OnePlus here, and it will send a push notification of the address to your Android device. And then when you leave the house, you can tap on it. It opens it up in Maps, and you can get directions or navigate or whatever. Just super handy. There's tons of ways to send links and map links from the desktop to your phone or to any device. But I found this one to be really, really, really nice because it's kind of right there in Maps and it opens up and you're right there, so you know where you're going when you leave your desk. So that's send to device in Google Maps, and I think it requires the newest version of Google Maps on your Android device to work.
And I forgot, I didn't hear what you said. You right-click on the pin on your desktop to send it?
It's in the card. So in the results, you'll have, like, a number of results listed, and there's, like, one of those white cards shows. So, like, I looked up, you know, Metrotech, which is a big office building near me here in Brooklyn, and in the, like, kind of white Google, it's the Google Now-like card. I guess it's a knowledge graph result. It gives me, you know, direction, save, the phone number, the address, and under the address, it says send to device.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time seeing it. Maybe I don't.
Click on that first.
I want to look up Twit and see if I get.
And then under details.
Under details.
See if it says send to device. Does it say send to device?
No, it says I can print it. Yeah, well, this is walking directions.
Oh.
That probably doesn't matter. Yeah, no, I'm not seeing it. Maybe I don't have the latest version of Maps installed.
Oh, interesting. Maybe it's rolling out to on the web as well.
Yeah, it probably is.
And I'm seeing, you know, I got the Keller Street address, and I see, you know, it's got links to save and directions and twit.tv, and I have this in open today 9 to 5, and then I have this saved send to device link. So,
And you're seeing this from the Maps interface or the Google interface?
In Maps, yeah.
In
so
Maps,
like,
okay.
Yeah, in Maps
yeah,
on,
no, I'm not
in,
seeing it.
In,
weird.
On the desktop. Oh,
weird.
That's crazy. Yeah,
I've always done the old, you know, you look in your search history. If you search for something on the desktop, and then I pull up my phone, and if I click on search, and then it says show your search history, it should be in there if you're logged in with the same account.
Oh, that's smart. Android Police has a screenshot of what it looks like in the card.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were showing that earlier, so.
Yeah, no, I'm not seeing that. Not yet, anyways.
Happy.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
The latest version of Google Maps installed, 9.1.1.0.
That's cool, though. I love that they're doing more of this integration that I think kind of seemed to start with Device Manager,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
where you could go onto the web and look up all of your devices through the web. And now they're integrating it into even search, just search in general. You can type in a search. I think it's Find My Phone, and it'll give you an option to do a pull down to find which phone you're talking about, and it'll ring your phone. Just different things like that, integrating that in. This is awesome. I'll totally use this.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. All right, Aaron, what's your thing?
So my thing today, usually I bring a project, and I've got a project in my bag, but as a backup. But I thought with all the recent discussion around Reddit and all the kerfuffle going on there, at least for me, it made me go out and look at a few Reddit alternatives. I went out and looked at Vote, V-O-A-T, if you're not familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, right.
That was one that a lot of people were recommending. But then another one that's still kind of in beta, and in fact, you have to get an invitation to use it, is called SnapZoo. Has anyone used SnapZoo at all?
No.
Anybody?
S-N-A-P-Z-U.
S-N-A-P-Z-U. This one came up, and I thought, well, I'll check it out. It looks pretty cool. One of the things that is cool about this is, and when you look at it at first, it likes, well, yeah, it's kind of a prettier looking Reddit. But then there's a button, and John, I don't know if you can click. There should be a mag button. Do you see the mag view button? Watch the magic happen. Ta-da! So now you have a magazine-style Reddit that still has the vote up and vote down buttons on it, but it's prettier to look at. I really prefer this view, maybe because I'm used to Google+. But I really like this view of browsing Reddit type content, especially if I'm using a desktop or a PC as opposed to using my phone. This works really, really well. I found the content to be pretty good, but they have a number of features that make this a real contender if you've never tried it. One of the things that they do, besides just the magazine front end, they have a leveling system for users where you collect experience points for contributing and being active within the community. So you know if this person posted it and their XP is, you know, this, wow, they're a really like experienced user and people trust that person to post really good content. They also have similarly a reputation system. They have they call their subreddits tribes, but they have a tribe mastery. So like if you are really well known for posting good content in technology, for example, it'll show your tribe mastery in technology is really high. And if you don't post a lot of cat content, I mean, who doesn't? Everybody does, right? But let's just imagine that you don't post a lot of cat content, your cat tribe mastery level will be low. So people can look at your profile if you want them to and say, oh, this guy really knows his stuff in technology. Another thing you can do that's really cool is for content. I've been frustrated with this before, both on Google Plus and Reddit. You go to post a picture of something, but then you can't also post a link to something else or a video that goes along with it or right. some additional content. Maybe it's a PDF you want them to download. They actually, when you submit content, you can create multiple content entries. So you post the picture, but then you also post the link to the website, the file to download, the whatever. And it all when you pull up the article, all those things come up. And not only you can do that, but other people can add to that header of the article to say, okay, I posted this picture, and then someone can put a link to where to buy that particular item or something like that. So it's some really cool stuff that they've added to this. You can follow certain users and things like that. It really is a pretty good system I found, and I wish them all the best. It seems like Reddit's kind of figured out what's going on over there a little bit. It seems like users are finally over all that mess that happened. I know I've been going back to Reddit now and kind of browsing at Reddit, but I'm still keeping my eye on SnapZoo for sure because it's a really, really cool. They've added a lot of really functional things to the whole Reddit upvote, downvote concept that I think could go a long way, especially if there's another problem over at Reddit.
Yeah, it's kind of prime time for someone to swoop in and
for sure
and throw Reddit off the throne.
Yeah,
are we witnessing the rapid demise of Reddit in literally in a few weeks?
I was really wondering whether that was going to be the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, but it looks like they might be in for one more straw.
Yeah,
just one more.
And one then, more straw.
I think it's all over. Just keep in mind, SnapZoo is invite only. You just go to the site, say I want an invite, and especially if you tweet about them, they're using that as a promotional tool. So if you tweet about them, they'll send you your invite, and you'll get in right away.
Cool. Very
nice.
Very neat. SnapZoo. SnapZoo. Look for that, not ZOO. My pick, if you want to call it that, is actually something that I guess you could do yourself because it's open to everybody, but it's intended for kids. Google has a summer camp. For your kids, it's virtual, of course, and it's free. Google Camp, it's called Camp Google. It actually began a couple of days ago, July 13th. It runs through August 7th. It's aimed at kids 7 to 10, but it's open to kids of all ages. And basically, Google teamed up with Khan Academy, National Park Service, National Geographic Kids, and NASA for the sessions and activities that they'll go through during this camp. Every week is a different theme. So one week is ocean, the next week space, nature, then and also music. And basically there's interactive live streams that kind of focus on the themes, activities, lessons with instructions and a supplies list so that the kids can kind of be active and involved in learning about this kind of stuff. Gamification, things like badges for achievements and all that kind of stuff. And then all of the lessons are archived in case they miss a day. And they instead of going outside and playing, they want to learn. Here you go. It's Camp Google. And I don't know. I think it's kind of neat. And it's free. So if you want to, point your kid to something to keep them occupied and make them even smarter than they already are, they should check that out. So look for Camp Google.
Yeah. I think this is great. Yeah. I think this is really good. And not to detract from this, but there's also Make Magazine does Maker Camps. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they partner with Makerspaces. So it's not just the online, but you can actually, if you have a Makerspace near you that's supporting it, you can actually go in. What they'll do is they'll do the streaming video and stuff, and then a lot of makerspaces will have a project to do that relates to that day's particular lesson. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing that next year at our makerspace, and this seems like a similar program. So I think it's great that people are taking advantage of the power of the internet to make these things possible for kids to do during the summer. It's fantastic.
Totally.
Nice.
All right. We survived. We did
nice
it.
Nice job, Jason.
Good job.
Oh, good job, us. We made it.
Thanks to John.
Yes, thank you. Big thank you to Jammer B. We didn't have a technical director before today's show began because normally I do that. And apparently we didn't figure that out. So, John, thank you so much for stepping in. Really appreciate it. And thanks to you guys for backing me up here. I guess we'll start with you, Jeff. Jeff, what you got going on? Obviously, you are the author of Geeks Bearing Gifts. What
it's
public
like
parts?
Howard Stern plug moment here.
Yes. Go ahead. Plug away. You'll probably do it a lot better than I will.
Nothing much new. I did an audio version of Geeks Bearing Gifts about soon. And if you're in media, if you're really wonkish, check out my blog. We have an event coming up on membership in media.
Nice, and that's Buzz
really,
Machine.
Really wonky.
Buzzmachine.com for that. Right on. Thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
Gina, so good to talk with you again, as always. What are you working on? I have a feeling I know, but I'll let you say it.
I got a couple of things, things going at the moment. But if you're wondering what the last thing I released is, some new features in ThinkUp, which I hope folks will check out. Go to thinkup.com. It's social media analytics for like regular people, and we just added support for Instagram, so you can see your best photos of the week, month, year, who your biggest fans are, and we also added search. You can search your followers' profiles for what company they work for, what kind of skills they have. So go check it out. It's free trial, no credit card required. That's thinkup.com. And yeah, in a couple of weeks I'll have something new that'll be open to the public. Makerbase, as I've mentioned before, is invite only still. Yes, we're still handing out invites slowly, but I've been hacking it on that every day. And next time you see me, I'll be talking more about that. So
that's awesome. With the inclusion of MakerBase, does that just like double the amount of work you have now? You were focused on one, and now you're focused on two. Is your life okay? Is your life work balance okay right now?
It's okay. Right. I try to follow my muse and work on the thing that's like kind of got me the most excited. Right. So I go back and forth. And then I collapse at the end of the day. Like you, Jason. I know you've had a really busy few weeks.
It's been busy. But I have PTO this weekend for a week, so I've got something to look forward to. That's a big reason why it's been so busy, because turns out when you're taking a week off, it's not like you don't do that work. Right. You just do it before you leave.
Right. Or after you get back.
After you get back. You're going to pay the price somehow. Aaron Newcomb, always a pleasure to get you on the shows. Thank you for coming up today and sitting next to me here. What you got working on?
Always glad to be here. You can follow what I'm doing on Google+. I'm Aaron Newcomb on Google+. Maybe you're interested in how I'm transitioning my house back to the 80s.
Really?
Yeah, you can take a look at that post. I actually got one of the old yellow phones. Put it in my kitchen and got it all wired up. We have the opposite problem of always have your phone out. I mean, that still happens, but we have those like wireless or cordless phones all around the house, and they're like in all the seat cushions. No one knows where they are. Mm-hmm. So I said, screw it. I'm going to get an old style phone, put it on
it's
the wall.
Always there. It's where always you expect there. To find it.
Everyone will know where
That's
it is.
Hilarious.
It rings really loud when the phone rings. Uh-huh. It's like, it's great.
So nothing really beats an analog ringer.
Nothing that's beats. Wow. That's right. The old style ring. It actually has a bell inside rings.
That's awesome.
Anyway, so that's the kind of stuff you can follow if you follow me on Google+. Also, if you're in the Bay Area and you want to come check out Benicia Makerspace, we just had our grand opening the other day. We're actually accepting membership now, and we've got a lot of cool projects. We built a chicken coop on Sunday. It was kind of fun. Somebody needed a chicken coop, so we built a chicken coop. And we've got some aquaponics stuff coming up this weekend. I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff going on. So if you're in the area, Northern California, Bay Area type thing, and you're looking for a makerspace, come check us out.
Radical. Check it out. Bravo. And Thank you, guys. As for me, you can find me at about.me/Jason Howell. Of course, I'm here all the time at Twit doing shows, producing Leo's shows, as well as my own. I've got All About Android Tuesday nights along with Ron Richards. And, you know, lots of awesome guests, including many of the pretty much everybody that you see here. And I also do Android App Arena, which is a show where I review Android apps, 3 to 4 great apps a week. Let me tell you, it's not easy to find 3 to 4 awesome apps each week to review. But somehow, some way, I figure it out. That's twit.tv/arena. You should definitely check it out. But as for this show, that's all she wrote. Next week, Leo Laporte is back sitting in this chair. Actually, now that I think about it, Jeff, I think you're possibly out next week, right?
I'm out next week, yes.
Okay, so sadly. I'm going to have to do some more work before I leave, but don't worry. Sorry, I will have that. A couple of awesome people here with the returning Leo.
Sorry, buddy.
Do not be sorry. It's part of what I do, so it's all good.
I will be at VidCon next week.
Oh, okay. I hear this is the year of VidCon. That's what I hear.
It's going to be amazing. There's the industry track, and I'm interviewing Young Turks, Cenk Uygar, on Friday morning.
Nice.
And VidCon just sold out. I don't know the history, but I would imagine they would. I don't know.
Yeah. Right on. We'll have a good time there.
Seems appropriate that they would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely, you know, come back next week and check out This Week in Google with Leo Laporte. You can watch this show recorded live every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. Post to the site later that day. Just go to twit.tv/TWIG for Twig. And you can find all of the past episodes for this show there. And I think that's about it. We'll see you guys next week with Leo sitting in this chair. Thank you so much for watching, you guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Great work, Jason.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks.
Very well done.
Have a good time off.
Thank you.